We can get started. I would say pleasure to introduce our social media star, Matt Phillips, who joined the restaurant from Silvers in London, where he did both his undergraduate degree and his PhD. Recently joined the department as a lecturer in modern Asian history, and we'll talk about something coming out of the forthcoming book as well. And you can read the title for yourselves. Matt, over to you.
Thank you very much. It does come out of my book, although I'd say it's sort of one of the least successful things I looked at. Like in the end, it didn't kind of quite make it into the PhD, like the actual sort of case study. So I was sort of bringing it back, and it was a bit of a ambitious and slightly mistake in the middle of a teaching semester to try and do this. But I wanted to do it because it was one of those things that the Royal Barges are so iconic. They are so kind of integral to the way in which people experience often Thailand, that presenting the issue of the barges in front of it didn't quite work somehow. And so I sort of in the end felt like there was so much going on, I sort of parked it. And I'm sort of wanting to sort of bring it back again. So the barges themselves, I think the case study at the end will be referenced in the end book, but the whether or not there's something in the barges, in the way that the barges are used, and this sort of bigger issue of spectacle, and, I think that there is something there which I feel like might be a good basis for discussion afterwards. So, from modern spectacle to spectacular modernity, Thailand's royal barges and the Cold War. So my research is sort of interested in the integration then of Thailand, both politically and economically, into what you might describe as the American Empire, but certainly an American-centered power during the Cold War. And what my thesis sought to show was that the role that cultural forms of identity played in securing the transition of Thailand from a fiercely independent country, seeking to secure an elusive sovereignty on the world stage during the 1930s through to the 1940s, to one that seemed apparently happily subservient to US interests in the context of the Cold War, particularly from 1958 onwards. And it was in this case that I stumbled across the barges. However, my thesis wasn't focused on spectacle, but rather upon the social debates that mapped this transition through to the 1960s. Events such as the Royal Barge Ceremony tended to become, therefore, subsumed into this larger narrative. So ultimately, what I have sought to prove into my thesis is that the emergence of a culturally distinctive form of Thai identity that emerged during the Cold War was a product primarily of the country's integration into the US sphere of influence and was part of a profoundly, importantly, modern experience of Thailand in the post-war era. And so it's in this way that I see the barges, not as the icons of Thai history, and they are historic, but rather as the products of a period of incredible political and economic uncertainty, when Thailand was only just emerging as a nation at all, when these icons of the past came to play an important role as markers of the present, helping to direct and eventually consolidate the ideological basis of Thai citizenship during the Cold War. So before I grapple with the issues of the barges, let me first try and provide a bit of background to my thesis and the Cold War more generally. Well, in some respects, it is easy to understand why a place like Thailand often gets overlooked when studying the Cold War. There is no major conflict in the country. There wasn't a time when Thailand was at any real risk of becoming communist. And throughout the Cold War, really from 1945 onwards, Thailand was a fairly solid ally to the United States. So it does, on the surface of it at least, seem to contrast with what is happening elsewhere on the continent. It looks, from the outside, perhaps as a rather stable location, and for such reasons has not really been incorporated into a central narrative about the Cold War. However, such a view of the Cold War fails to recognise how ideology was constructed not only in spheres of conflict, but also in spheres of peace. In this case, the story as to how America developed a close relationship with an Asian partner is important, both in the way that it helps explain how the United States sought to expand its own interests in the region, and how an ally was drawn so completely into its grasp, not only politically, but economically, and critically, culturally. In fact, what we find in the construction of Thailand by American writers, and indeed policymakers,
is that the country's apparent stability and the lack of a communist threat was a major reason for American interest in the country. However, underlying that relationship was an earlier recognition that what really made Thailand an attractive US focus of the interest of the United States was that it had never been colonized. That the ever-present fact that frustrated American dreams of peaceful expansion and engagement elsewhere. In a practical way, of course, decolonization severely limited the US ability to achieve regional objectives in Southeast Asia. So you had the First Indochina War, which of course was being fought between the French and the Viet Minh. The Americans were massively frustrated about the fact that they couldn't influence it. They couldn't influence it, how the French were managing the war, but most importantly, they couldn't influence the propaganda. They struggled to build that relationship, to establish distance with the French, who were viewed obviously as imperialists, and which the Americans did not want to see them have themselves seen as. And so they were very interested, particularly in 1953. You see, Thailand becomes the centre for the United States psychological warfare strategy in Southeast Asia. But Thailand is the only space where Americans can operate freely to sort of build a active propaganda campaign. But what also was attractive about Thailand, this stability, this historic independence, what was attractive there also was to American popular culture. In this era of American expansion of post-1945, a huge amount of effort in the US media to get Americans to think globally, to think in an expansionist way, to think about how they could move freely in new frontiers, Thailand becomes an ideal location because it is the only place in Asia, not only where apparently communism is not a threat, but also has not been colonized. As Peggy Durden explained in the New York Times in 1957, the visitor with the white skin in Asia not only observes, but also experiences the self-assertion of ex-colonial people. He is the object of their neurotic suspicions and fears, their long-suppressed resentments and hatreds, as well as their gentleness and generosity. So Asia is constructed in the US media as a dangerous location, as a place which is a challenging and dangerous, violent place for Americans to interact. In contrast, Thailand, because of its historic independence, was presented as a country where Americans could easily come to work and play amongst a population that lacked the hostility to white men and women. Whilst most of the region was seen as off-limits, Americans were frequently portrayed as welcome in Thailand, and as a result, able to act freely, and most importantly, to act freely to set up businesses. So, as Life magazine explains in 1951, unlike other parts of Asia, where Americans and other Westerners now have to step carefully, the changes in the Thai government have had absolutely no effect on the foreigners in Bangkok. So we can see that the political instability that's going on in the background is referenced, but foreigners are not affected. Because Thailand, an independent monarchy for six centuries, was never anybody's colony, there is no resentment to foreign imperialists. As the Cold War develops and the fight against communism comes to dominate the desire for a benevolent expansion into Asia, so we see this shift, this gradual shift away from America's desire to expand into Asia, more to the protection of the Asian peoples from the communist threat. Yeah, the idea that Asians are themselves inherently not communist, that communism is a foreign ideology that will come in, and that Americans can help to secure that. And Thailand is used again as a sort of model of a country that needs American protection. The example that I found most useful to express this was the title and the end of my thesis, which was a time-incorporated film from 1953, Oasis on a Troubled Continent, in which Thailand is explained, in which the people of Thailand, the land of the free, take as much satisfaction from the dramatic traditions of the past as in the comfortable prosperity of the present. Today, this peaceful and easygoing nation is surrounded by all sides by communist aggression, which threatens its very existence. So this is the text, this is the narration to a documentary film, a time-incorporated documentary that was put out in 1953. So now we can see the shift now to culture as a way, the establishment of Thai history, historic independence, tradition, cultural way of lives, as a narrative that is being used to set up Thailand as a place that needs protection from communism. Important, however, is to recognise that whilst this is a construction, it fails to have a space for Thai history. The actual experience of the Thai past that has come prior to 1945 is entirely not referenced, is entirely written out of America. The recent past is seen as an aberration and is seen as irrelevant to understanding contemporary Thailand. In fact, the story of Thailand up to the end of the Second World War was far removed from the pictures that Americans had painted of the country. In fact, what we see, if we go back to the 1930s, is a country obsessed with a local modernity, free from the conditions placed upon it by external powers. In fact, what we see is that since the revolution of 1932, when absolute monarchy had been deposed, defining independence had become a primary and overriding concern for the Thai regime, as those in power continued to find themselves unable to bring about the economic and political transformation that they sought as a result of the imposed conditions placed upon them by the world economy, by the relationships to the European and colonial powers. By the end of the 1930s, these frustrations were used to legitimise a shift towards authoritarian rule under the governance of Phibon Song Kram. And from 1939, Thais were encouraged, now by the state, to think of themselves as civilised participants in the world economy, equal if not better to their European overlords. But, importantly, kept back due to Western racisms and the failure of past governments to reject those racisms. Demands by the state were made that asked Thais to change their behaviour so that they could not be judged on the world stage. In this context, the totalising force of history was used to assert the need for further, locally derived forms of progress that nevertheless rejected the idea that the trappings of civilisation, consumerism, beauty, manners, came from the West, but that they were universal. As a government radio announcement explained in 1939, our current condition is as follows. We live in a country that is progressing, but the status of the Thai people continue to lag behind. Thailand really is now the authentic land of the Thais, but Thais are not yet to fully acknowledge themselves as perfectly Thai. Cultural policy up to the outbreak of the Pacific War, when of course Thailand was to become an ally of Japan and declared war on America and Britain, another handy thing to write out of the history, was thus focused primarily upon establishing Thailand as a modern nation. Thai history might have been important as a way of establishing the inherent civility of the Thai race, but history was also vital as a way of marking out modernity. References to the past, as can be seen in the announcement I just gave, placed it as an important precursor to the present, but there was little to no interest in notions of stability or stagnation. History moved in only one direction, and the Thai people needed to keep up if they were not to be subsumed under a new great empire. And this was absolutely pivotal. Absolutely pivotal. Everything that was written, both public and private, the recognition that the world was heading towards a world of great empires and that Thailand needed to be one or die. That was it. And with this can also be seen, in the way that the state created spectacle. So we can see this thing in the way that the state created spectacle. With historic entities, iconic references to the past consigned to the National Museum, and everyday spectacles such as the 10-day Constitution Day or Nation Day used only to proclaim modernity and to stake these, and to have the state stake its own claim over modernity. So you had stalls all around Bangkok. Bangkok was set up in incredibly elaborate stalls. Thousands of people moving in from on the train lines into the centre, into the city, to experience a modern nation provided for them by the government. The Miss Thailand contest, which was probably the most important event at the Constitution Day Fair, of course, again, conforming to ideas of self-improvement, self-betterment. Self-betterment is a way to achieve civilisation, beauty, and parity, ultimately, with Westerners. So what happens during the Cold War? Well, the emphasis on modernity in Bangkok continues, of course, that Thais are humiliated by the end of the war. They are humiliated by the fact that they are on the wrong side. They are humiliated by the fact that there is an economic collapse at the end of the war because they had to loan the Japanese so much money that the inflation goes through the roof. They are no longer able to dress in a civilised fashion. Asian decolonization removes Thailand's uniqueness in Asia, removes its claim to being the only civilized nation in Asia, apart from Japan, of course, excuse me. And then the giving up of territories, and this was an absolute, we hear about these wranglings between Thailand and Cambodia today, about this little piece of land on the, well, I mean, the sense of humiliation having to give up those territories at the end of the war was absolutely devastating. The newspapers were full day to day with anger, particularly towards the British and the French for forcing them to give up, particularly that section of Cambodia, which they saw as their own. And these things really fundamentally undermined Thailand's status, and it fundamentally undermined Thailand's belief in the popular culture, in society generally, that Thailand was able to maintain this modernity on its own. And what you have coming into this space in the early part of the Cold War, and this is from 1954, is America ploughing huge amounts of money and effort into beating the communists, and this is primarily what it's about. It's about beating the Soviets, who have their stall, to convince the Thais that America is it. America is the peak of modernity, that there is nothing more modern than America. And so in 1954, they set up this fair, this stand at the Constitution Day Fair. This is in Bangkok. It's, you know, it could almost be as a world fair. It was extraordinary amounts of money. They had a fashion show, they had Miss Pepsi World, they had Ford and Chevrolet and General Electric and all of these stands showing off all this stuff. And then they had, they erected the first ever Cinerama screen in Asia for the course of the month that Constitution Day was running. So Thais were the first to experience what is the precursor to the IMAX in Bangkok. So, crucially as well, Peabon comes back into power in 1948. So Peabon is back in power in 1948. The old government is back, but in a sort of slightly renewed form. But Peabon, who is leading the whole thing, continues to take own to build his credibility, build his legitimacy on the idea that there can be a vernacular Thai modernity, that he rejects the idea. And in fact, what we find in 1954 is that the next year, Constitution Day is cancelled. Right, there's nothing in the sources that says it was cancelled because the Americans had undermined Thai modernity. But in the papers, that's exactly what the narrative was, that all of the Thai stalls looked shabby and old. They were the same things that had been there 10 years ago, let alone... And this was the peak of civility. This was the peak of modernity. That's exactly the word that was used to describe Cinerama screen. Cinerama screen was civilization at the moment. That was the way it was. Oh yes, this is. I'll just mention this quickly. This is the United States' own assertions about what their intentions were with the propaganda in Thailand. What you have then in the 1950s is this alliance between people and the Americans. Between the Thai government and the Americans, but that itself is causing all sorts of problems for the Thai government itself, because discussions in the media see Peabon as a puppet to the Americans, and so the Americans and Peabon, they were working to try and distance themselves from each other. And actually, what you can see here, and particularly this bottom one here, is the Americans see. The need to exploit the myth of a traditional freedom that gives the Thai a sense of separateness not felt by other countries. Yeah, they need to distance themselves from the current regime, and they need to give the Thais a sense of separateness not felt by neighbouring countries. The psychological climate, therefore, is unified, stabilised, and conservatised by traditional Thai attitudes toward king, country, and religion. And of course, the major thing that happens here is the rehabilitation of the monarch. That King Bhumibol is rehabilitated in order to bring him back as a major emblem of state power. So, 1955 is the Bandung Conference. The relationship then between Thailand and America has deteriorated ever since the Geneva Accords, and then in 1954-55 when CETO comes into effect. Essentially, CETO is not what the Thais want. So the Thais are getting less than they want from the Americans, and also the relationship with the Americans is causing the Thai regime an awful lot of problems at home. So there's this desire to distance people, and people want to distance himself from the Americans. And he does that. This is some examples in the Thai media of people being mocked by Thai writers at his relationship to the Americans. So he's able to use his knowledge of Thai fortune-telling to explain to Dulles and Eisenhower what's going to happen in the Cold War. And of course, the idea is here that Peabon is basically bringing the Cold War to Thailand unnecessarily, that the Cold War doesn't belong here. But he's using all of these things, this quack quack formulas to convince the Americans that Thailand is desperately in need of this aid and it needs support, and you must keep on giving it to us. When, of course, and then is increasingly as well then depicted his wartime experience as a fascist dictator, which is increasingly how he's now cast, is used against him. So how does Pei Bon seek to rectify the situation? How does Pei Bon seek to rehabilitate his own reputation, but also his the vernacular Thai modernity? Because that's the basis upon which he sees his ability to, his stake to claim, his legitimacy within the Thai political system. Well, he pins his hopes on an event which is due to take place in the year 2500, which in our calendar is 1957. The year 2500 is the meridian year of the Buddhist calendar. And he sets an election up for 1957. He sets an election for 1957 in February. The Buddhist meridian is due to take place in May. And he uses then the next 2 years to basically tour around the country using Buddhism as a way of rehabilitating himself. And he decides to bring back the barges. The barges have been consigned to history. The last time that they were used was in 1932, as part of the absolute monarchy's own, and there's a whole backstory there which we can talk about in questions. But he decides in the early 1950s to bring back the barges as a living part of Thai statecraft. There is a long debate about whether or not to put them in a museum or to actually use them. And in order to use them, they have to go to great lengths to find people who are still alive who know how to use them. They'd all been destroyed during the Second World War, so they had to be put back together. They needed the artisans, there were no one left. It was an incredibly difficult job to get them back up and running. And there was never going to be as many barges around as there were before. But they do decide to bring them back, and they are brought back as the sort of focal point for the celebrations for the year 2500. But, importantly, Pei Bon continues to express his commitment to a Thai modernity as a way of selling himself. So there's an election campaign poster in December 1956, the man who built the Thai nation, Pei Bon Son Graham. Vote for the man that built Thailand. And commitments are made in his election manifesto to connect the whole country by road, to electrify more. It's all about commitments to a development, to a modernity. But now we've got this sort of attempt to legitimise it more and more with cultural icons from a Thai past and also with Buddhism. Buddhism is great because it allows him to invite U Nu of Burma, to not invite any Americans, obviously. The inference of Buddhism is that this is the middle way, is used to express Thailand's new commitment to neutrality in the Cold War as opposed to a commitment to America. And there is definite signs that Thailand, under Pei Bon, is ready to move away from America as a formal ally in the Cold War. And this is a picture of the royal barge being brought out, really, for the first time. Now, the problem that Pei Bon had was, the event itself, but what had happened was is that the election had gone forward, the opposition had immediately cried foul, said it was rigged, there'd been protests in the street, and in the end, the events around the year 2500 become a massive white elephant. Pei Bon's big commitment to the event was undermined by the fact that he had himself changed the meaning of the event. So the meridian was actually the point where Buddhism was about to go into decline, but he, because of this desire to push it and to use it as a revival, a renewal of his own power, he twists it and he asks all monks to rewrite it as a revival of Buddhism rather than a meridian. Well, this gets out and it's all seen as a little bit inauthentic. And then the other problem is that obviously the opposition decide to boycott the event, and then the worst thing that could ever happen, the king fails to turn up for the crucial ceremony. So the 3 days of ceremonies that took place, again, in the press, widely reported that 65 million baht spent, huge amounts of money. It was an event of incredible national spread. I mean, you had stuff going on all around the country. As far as I can tell, there was events going on in almost every temple in every part of the country. but the event is deemed a failure, and it is then, most importantly, written up as a failure. And what I'm just going to show you here is some examples of the how this magazine, this is a magazine actually published a couple of months after the event, but in a way more interesting then about how the way in which it seeks to represent it. So the magazine itself, the first thing it did was reference the 65 million spent and ask the reader to think about how much value that 65 million pounds had. But it does recognise that these are stunning and very, very important. That whatever we're going to say about the event as a whole, this is something we need to think about for the future. However, for now, this was a failure. And this was a failure principally because those in control, sorry, this is a very bad photo, this is from the magazine, it was a tiny little one at the bottom. Because those who put the event together were out of touch with those who attended it. And here we have the seniors, as they are called, the elder statesmen, in the magazine, the elder statesmen who with their airs and graces sitting at the front of the event. Here is a picture of the crowds. One might think this is a sign of success. Hundreds of thousands of people turn up, but the caption informs us that they all turned up to see the king, but the king didn't turn up to see them. And finally, the event itself, the Royal Barge Ceremony. Again, interesting, very interesting that there is this picture, prominent picture of the crowd there to watch the Royal Barges. But, again, whilst we might look at this and say, it's a success. There's loads of people there and they're all watching the barges. But the caption informed us that this was entirely unorganised, nobody knew what to do, where to say, they couldn't see anything, it was a complete mess. That most people they couldn't go to the toilet, there was absolutely no thought or interest in the people who had turned up. And that, in the end, was how the whole event was depicted. It was depicted as an event where the people who went, who turned up for the event, who went to pray, made merit for the Buddha, did it because they were Thai. They came to see the barges because they were Thai, because there was a cultural connection to these things, but ultimately the regime failed in its in creating any sense of legitimacy around those cultural icons. So what happens? Okay, Peabon is deposed, Nikku in 1957, a year later. This guy finally takes full charge. He actually takes charge straight away, but there's a sort of complicated bit in the middle, which we'll get into now. He becomes full leader of Thailand in 1958, after what he describes as a revolution. A revolution which is also a cultural restoration, but which uses culture, importantly, to undermine and end, in many respects, Thai citizen rights. So he tears up the constitution, he rules by decree rather than by formal legal processes that have been established over the last 25 years, and he builds up this whole regime's legitimacy upon a cultural ideology where the king and queen are centre. And here we see the king and queen as part of this new regime taking a trip through America and, of course, meeting with Elvis. Probably the most important moment in Thai history. Sorry, that was different. Okay, so how does the barge ceremony then re-emerge? How does the barge ceremony come back, and this time successfully? What is the barge ceremony when it finally is integrated into a political regime that makes sense? Well, in many respects, we don't know, because all media from 1958 is entirely censored. However, what is interesting is, of course, that it survives to this day. The narratives that underlie the Royal Barge Ceremony and the way in which it is incorporated into Thailand, contemporary Thailand, still is very much based upon how it was built up, constructed during this period. So this is the model that works. This is the model that makes sense. So unsurprisingly, cultural icons once again become vital, and it was soon decided under Surit that events such as the barge ceremony should be brought under the jurisdiction of a newly formed organisation, the Tourist Authority, which itself would act as both a promoter of the industry, but also as a producer of Cold War ideology to a Thai population. In terms of the royal barges, rather than a focus on the use of boats and ceremonial activities, the primary concern in the formative months of the organisation was the issue of providing a suitable place to dock the boats so that the large numbers of foreigners could view them. This was another very interesting thing about going back into the sources, that in 1946, when there was an initial discussion about what to do with the boats that had been damaged during the war, there was a note made that the only people that ever visited them, even then, were foreigners. Foreigners knew about these boats, in a way more than the Thais did themselves. Then, from 1961, the tourist authority began to exploit the event, the Royal Barge Ceremony, as a primary tourist attraction in the calendar, actively participating in its organisation and promoting it as one of the most important tourist events of the year. And I should also just point out that the event, the Royal Barge Ceremony itself, is something called the Thot Katin, which is an annual event linked to the Thai calendar, where monks are returning from. It is the event that in the past was where the barges were used ceremonially. However, whilst the tourist authority was responsible for explaining the event to foreigners, it also sought to explain the event to the Thais. So one of the most conspicuous incidents of this was in the tourist authority's own Thai language magazine, Osotor magazine, which was a publication printed for an urban readership about tourist activities. So it was always a set of discussions about what the tourist activity meant to the foreigner and what it meant as a Thai experiencing it. So I'm going to finish by really just going through this article. This is an article, this is from the English language publication, but the article that I'm going to talk you through is the Thai language publication. And interesting again, we also now have a picture of the grandstand. No longer the higgledy-piggledy mess on the side of the river, but now it's a grandstand full of people. So the article, written not by a staff member but by a Thai, who had taken two foreign friends to the occasion, was an account in praise of those who had organised it, and therefore explained that the event had been put together by the tourist authority and the Navy, who had worked together to organise it in order to welcome foreign tourists who wanted to come and watch the troop of barges. His account of the experience from beginning to end was therefore one in which those responsible had thought things through to the finest detail so that they might provide the onlookers with exactly the experience they thought. It explained how upon arrival at the back of Wat Arun, the three passengers found a Navy officer who smiled at them and politely directed them to the car park, which he found parked with cars and tourist buses. Having parked the car, he described walking toward the enclosure, demarcated by a piece of rope, where he found the entrance manned by a member of the tourist authority, busy directing people to their seats in the grandstand. From there, the day's event was one which he described as spectacular from beginning to end, crammed full of photo opportunities and moments of total awe. It was an experience of unrivaled entertainment. Quote, as for the many hours spent in the grandstand, staring at the Chao Phraya River flowing past, well, you might have expected it to be a period of isolation, of boredom. But on that day, it was the complete opposite. It was fun from beginning to end. And I did not feel bored, isolated, or sleepy for one moment, because opposite to the grandstand, there was a stage which had been put up by the Navy, in which the tourist authority had organised entertainment of the highest quality. These elaborate dancing and theatrical displays meant that some used their camera film before the barge ceremony had already begun. But the tourist authority had thought about that too, because they had organised a stall selling camera film. So what is noticeable about the account was the way he clearly identifies the experience of the barge ceremony as an activity organised for an elite community of foreign visitors and the Thai urbanites who had accompanied them. He noted, for example, how throughout the afternoon there was a floating bar which had been set up to sell snacks such as hot dogs and fizzy drinks for visitors. He also found that the toilet situation was particularly impressive, noting that this was one of the hardest things to organise, but that they were of such high standard that they, quote, made me feel shy because they were better even than the toilets in my house. He noted how the grandstand was of a very high quality and how it had been erected at a perfect angle to the river to give the spectators a perfect view of the event as it unfolded. Quote, meaning the sun didn't get into the eyes and you could take the most beautiful pictures. Then, at 3 p.m., those sitting on the grandstand started to alert each other that there was something happening on the opposite side of the river, on the dock outside of the Royal Palace. clamouring to see and getting out their optical zoom cameras to zoom in on the activities, the crowd got excited as they realised the King, the Queen and the Crown Prince were getting into the white royal motorboat in order to leave for the start of the ceremony upriver. After an hour of further entertainment, members of the Tourist Authority staff started to gather in the space between the grandstand and the river, and a loudspeaker announced that everybody was to go back to their seats because the procession was coming around a bend in the river and would shortly be coming into view. The author then explained how the procession, from being just a dot in the distance, moved slowly closer until finally the full procession was in view. The rhythmic sound of the oars entering in and out of the water, pulling the boats along, arranged together in a perfect line. With the crowd enraptured, the article continued to assert the experience as one of global participation in a cultural exchange of unity over and across the national boundaries, established by the fact that the event was a tourist event. But what was most notable was the agreement about what a commitment to that common ground entailed. Quote, "It was put together beautifully, and would be even more beautiful if it weren't for the modern new buildings being built around it. It wasn't just me who thought this. Everybody there commented on how the new buildings ruined this beautiful vista of the past." And that the situation, I think I wrote this out actually, and that the situation would only continue and that we should quickly work together to protect it. Okay, so to conclude. So I think that's the key point. I think that's the key statement about the whole experience. Okay, yes, this is an experience of urban ties with their counterparts, with their American counterparts, with the American visitors, who are going to participate now in what is primary narrative, the other primary narrative of the Soviet era, development. Thailand experiences 7% growth year on year from 1960 onwards. It enacts grand development plans. And there's no question that the modernity that Thailand sees from 1960 onwards is quite different to the modernity that it experienced prior. But in order for that modernity, that development narrative to take root, to take shape, and to work successfully, it needs the complicity, it needs to gain the hearts and minds of the most important group for this to happen, the urban Thai. The urban Thai made up of Chinese Thai, of bureaucratic Thai, of elite royalist Thai, and also, of course, leftists. Because leftists were equally as enraptured by a story about the past and about rural Thailand as anybody else. So this narrative brings in all these groups together into an experience with America that feels benevolent, that feels genuine, and that is most importantly putting Thailand at its centre. But of course it isn't Thailand that is at the centre. It's America that is at the centre. Because the story of growth under this system is of American-led growth, where those that get rich are those that have a relationship with the Americans, and that's in a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the overall Thai population. So my understanding of this event, and the importance of the grandstand is that Thailand moves from a situation where it is chasing modernity, it is having spectacles that are focused on this chase towards modernity, to experiencing modernity. That this is America, this is Thailand's, in many respects, full integration into the cultural narrative of American imperialism. Hence, spectacular modernity. Thank you.